While council is getting settled, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeal. This is the third and final case on our oral argument calendar today. My name is Kayla Eid. I'm serving as presiding judge today, and I'm joined by Judge Larkin on my left and Judge Connolly on my right. This is A240205, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Max Leo Miller, Appellant. Counsel for Appellant will have 15 minutes for the initial argument and 5 for rebuttal. Counsel Respondent will have 15 minutes. The podium is adjustable. There will be an oral argument, an audio recording of the oral argument on our website later this afternoon or tomorrow. This is also live streaming, but there is to be no other recording of this proceeding other than the official audio that will go up on our website. Counsel, when you begin, please introduce yourself and let us know how you'd like us to refer to you, and counsel for appellant whenever you're ready.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Rebecca Ireland, and I represent the appellant Max Miller. Following a jury trial, Mr. Miller was convicted of third-degree murder for proximately causing the death of another by providing a narcotic. At trial, the state introduced into evidence toxicology results and expert testimony about those results to prove that the drugs that Mr. Miller provided the victim caused his death. Because the analyst who conducted the toxicology lab testing upon which the expert witnesses relied did not testify at the trial, Mr. Miller's confrontation rights were violated, and the error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Accordingly, this court must reverse and remand for a new trial. I want to do two things today. One, establish the scope of the admissible evidence. And two, make clear that the toxicology evidence was directly relevant to, even determinative of trial issues of what proximately caused the victim's death. As to the first, the respondent concedes that the toxicology evidence was inadmissible under Crawford, but then misidentifies the scope of that very evidence. Respondent appears to argue that the lab report itself, as an exhibit, was inadmissible. In his brief, the counsel for respondent wholly overlooks the fact that the toxicology results came into evidence not just through an exhibit, but in great detail through live witness testimony of the medical examiner and the surrogate lab witness, and both witnesses further offered additional opinion about what the toxicology meant, and that went to specific circumstances of the victim's death. So the error is not limited to the report itself. The opinion testimony that relied on that toxicology lab analyst's assertion falls well under Crawford and was inadmissible because there lacked cross-examination of the testing analyst. This is clear black-letter law, and accordingly, I think it's important to correctly identify the scope of all that evidence because it influences this court's impact analysis.
Ms. Ireland, I got a little different take of the respondent's case. I thought the argument was the proximate cause was not contested at trial. It was who provided the lethal dose of drugs. So first of all, do you agree with that? And second, even if you don't, why is it still wrong?
I don't agree with that articulation. Proximate cause of death was an essential element that the state had to prove, and that was the very issue at trial. What caused the victim's death, and was it the drugs that Mr. Miller supplied caused the death? That was absolutely contested, and there's no way in which...
So if we were to look at the record, there was no argument that, like, no, it wasn't Mr. Miller who gave him these drugs, it was Mr. Jones, and you should be looking to Mr. Jones because Mr. Jones was supplying these drugs around the same time as Mr. Miller, and so, you know, who knows. So that was not the defense at trial.
That was the defense at trial. The evidence at trial established that the victim had numerous drugs in his system and on the date of his death had taken illicit drugs at various points in the day. The state's witnesses established that earlier in the day, following a dental appointment, the victim took street Xanax with an individual, and the friend, the individual that took the street Xanax with him, testified that he believed that Xanax was laced with fentanyl because he tested positive himself personally for fentanyl that day after the police instructed him to do so. So that was absolutely the defense's defense and theory of the case that they argued. They said, look, the state didn't prove which of the drugs killed the victim. It could have been drugs that he took earlier in the day. And the main point I want to make very clear today is the toxicology was conclusive proof that settled that dispute.
As to which drugs?
As to which drugs.
And obviously that goes, then which person?
Which person, okay. And proximate cause of death, absolutely. If there are no...
You win, don't you?
Yes. Yes. And I'll draw that point out further. I endeavor this morning to make that very clear, how the toxicology evidence went directly to the main disputed issue at trial. The state has argued that the toxicology had little persuasive value, and that is meritless. There can be no mistake that the toxicology was critical probative evidence of what caused the victim's death, and importantly, whether it was Mr. Miller's drugs proximately causing the death. And the toxicology decisively resolved both of those questions in the state's favor. And this is so because, remember, the medical examiner told the jury, I cannot determine cause of death without toxicology in this case. He said, it is impossible for him to say if a drug caused death by looking at the body, adding, that's why you have to send the blood specimens out to the laboratory. Only by obtaining the toxicology could Mr. McGee tell the jury that he determined that the victim had a lethal dosage of fentanyl, which caused a sudden death. Importantly, the surrogate lab witness testified to the same or similar, saying the toxicology indicated a rapid, very sudden death occurring after fentanyl ingestion. The upshot of this testimony is that it was conclusive proof and the state's very best proof that the drugs taken last in time, which were undoubtedly Mr. Miller's drugs, are what caused the victim's death. We cannot say that this evidence did not tip the scale. It certainly tipped the scale in the state's favor.
What about circumstantial evidence? The picture, you know, that's too big, slow down, or take a minute, try half of that. Why couldn't the jury have concluded based on that evidence that, or why shouldn't we conclude that based on that evidence, the admission of the toxicology results was harmless beyond reasonable doubt?
The law doesn't allow you to draw that conclusion because the question is not whether there was other sufficient evidence upon which the jury could convict. It's whether this evidence really swayed the jury. And this evidence was the highly persuasive, most conclusive scientific evidence resolving that question. Without the toxicology, imagine how the trial would have unfolded. Certainly the state's argument, theory of the case, that there were numerous drugs, even ones potentially containing fentanyl, that the victim took that day, and the state can't show which one caused the death. The toxicology was necessary to put that question to bed. I also want to address respondents' apparent claim that the prosecution didn't rely on the toxicology evidence. This is wrong. The state referred to it in its opening statement, closing argument, and lasered in on it on rebuttal. The state argued to the jury that the toxicology showed that Mr. Miller was the proximate cause of death, and the drugs earlier in the day couldn't have killed the victim. The state tried to rebut this and say, well, perhaps the Xanax taken earlier in the day killed the victim. And on rebuttal, the state said, look at the toxicology. It is conclusive proof that that is impossible. We know from the toxicology that the victim died very suddenly, if not immediately, upon ingesting the fatal dose of fentanyl. And this question resolves that the drugs last in time, Mr. Miller's drugs, would have been the cause of death then.
Do you have a position that this would be the, potentially could be the first Minnesota case in a precedential opinion that applies Smith? Do you have a position on whether or not this opinion should be precedential?
I think it should be. There's good reason that the opinion in this case be precedential, certainly in light of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Smith, which is squarely on point here, and is a case that directs that the Confrontation Clause does not permit so-called independent expert testimony based on another expert's lab results without cross-examination of that underlying testing analyst. I would also note that there's no precedential opinion in Minnesota on confrontation error involving lab reports since 2007. And certainly there hasn't been one that I'm aware of, again, precedential opinion following Bull Cumming from the U.S. Supreme Court in 2011. And that is the leading case that surrogate witness testimony on lab results is prohibited, absent the opportunity for cross-examination if the testing witness is unavailable.
There's no precedential decision applying Bull Cumming in that way? Is that
I'm not aware of a Minnesota case following Bull Cumming that is precedential addressing confrontation error. So there's good reason to issue a precedential opinion in this case. I want to make a few other points this morning, briefly. As to the factor in this court's impact analysis as to whether Mr. Miller at trial effectively countered the toxicology evidence, there can be no credible claim that he did. And what countering means in this context, we know from Caulfield, means countering the lab results on the merits as to veracity. So that's an important point I would like for this court to consider. And in Caulfield, the court said all the defendant could do was object on admissibility grounds. But once that evidence came in, he couldn't even try to rebut the evidence. And we know that unrebutted forensic evidence is more likely to impact a verdict. And as to the argument that the jury could have reached the same conclusion based on other evidence in the record, an issue I don't concede, but would note that that is not the relevant question. To Judge Eade's question earlier, this court looks to whether it's reasonable that the jury was swayed by the toxicology evidence. And I would argue in this case, we can be certain that it did. The toxicology evidence went directly and conclusively to an essential element of the offense, the probable cause of death. Unless there are additional questions, I will address the court on rebuttal. I would want to make clear my request for relief is to reverse and remand for a new trial based on the improper admission of the toxicology evidence on which the state relied.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, my name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. The issue in this case is how did the drugs that killed the victim in this case get into his system? The challenged evidence in this case, the analyst's report that showed the presence of several drugs in the victim's system during his autopsy, confirmed what everyone knew. And what everyone that tried the case knew, that he died of mixed drug toxicity. That was true even before the report had been prepared. The only issue at trial was who supplied those drugs. The unique facts of this case provided a trove of evidence, including incriminating text messages exchanged between the victim and the appellant shortly before the victim died. All that evidence pointed squarely at appellant as the person who supplied the drugs to the victim and caused his death. I'll admit, I've been doing this for a long time. When I read opposing counsel's brief and I looked at the analyst's report, I thought I'm going to have to concede the violation under Arizona.
Do you agree with the scope of the violation argument that your counterpart made in her argument that it's not limited to the admission of the exhibit itself, but to extends also to the testimony about the toxicology results?
It does extend to any testimony that directly references that report. I agreed with that.
And then extrapolating from that, would you agree that we have to consider that in terms of pervasiveness and persuasiveness in terms of evaluating harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? because it's not just one report, it's the jury's hearing it and seeing it.
Correct. But the point is, did it have a substantial effect on the verdict? How he died, that wasn't contested below. It's who provided him with the drugs that killed him. And on that issue, the report had very little persuasive evidence whatsoever. And if you look at the factors, the Trifoletti factors, it doesn't weigh at all on that specific issue. And even today, defendant effectively countered that evidence. Even today, they've brought up the fact that the victim's best friend, who was doing Xanax with him, went into the hospital and found out that he had tested positive for fentanyl. That evidence was brought up to try and show that there could have been an alternate method, an alternate means for the victim to have ingested fentanyl.
But how can they conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that argument wouldn't have been much more persuasive to the jury had there not been this toxicology evidence?
Based on the toxicologist's Swiatek, her testimony, her general testimony about how fentanyl works. She testified that opioids work extremely quickly. Heroin is metabolized too fast. They don't even test for it. It immediately turns into, I can't remember the first metabolite, and then it turns into morphine. It's undisputed that he did that Xanax well before noon with his friend. So if he ingested fentanyl with his friend at noon, why does it wait until 8:10 when he's found and now all of a sudden he's non-responsive? That could be easily discounted by the jury and apparently was discounted by the jury. But my point is that the defense counsel relied on the report, the fact that there was fentanyl in his bloodstream, to then try and point the finger to somebody else. And at the end of the day, here's what the closing argument was. And this is from page 312 on to page 399. All we know is he overdosed from some mix of drugs from some person, whether it be from Mr. Hammond or from some other unidentified person. That was the argument. Lots of discussion about the sheriff had flushed marijuana down the toilet at the scene of the crime, had destroyed evidence. There could have been fentanyl on that. There could have been fentanyl introduced in any number of different ways. That was the argument. So, and the fact that he had fentanyl in his bloodstream, that there were metabolites of heroin in his bloodstream, that doesn't point a finger at anyone. What points the finger is they found the torn off gem baggie, and it tested positive for heroin and fentanyl. That baggie looks exactly like the baggie that is in the photograph. And that's why this is such a unique case. We have text messages and photographs of a play-by-play of the purchase of the heroin and the ingestion of it. And we know we have a time frame from the victim's girlfriend. She's on the phone with him at 7:40 telling her boyfriend, "I'm on my way over." She gets delayed on the way, but she eventually arrives shortly after 8 o'clock. He doesn't answer his phone. He doesn't come to the door, so she's forced to barge in. But at 8:10, she finds him non-responsive.
I mean, isn't, though, the difference, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the alternative theory was the best, you know, the Xanax with fentanyl, but the toxicology report established that it was heroin with fentanyl, and that's allegedly what Mr. Miller gave the victim. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So then the toxicology report is determinative of what he died. It had been heroin and fentanyl, which supposedly Mr. Miller gave him, but Miller did not have an opportunity to cross-examine the person who did the report and say, well, you know, I mean, you know, to do all the stuff you do on cross-examination, well, how do I know, you know, did you measure this, did you measure that, you know, you know, blah, 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 blah. And that was the point that denied him the right to confront, to point out errors in the toxicology report. Now, why is that wrong?
Well, the Xanax found at the scene, I believe, was field tested, and it tested negative for fentanyl. And I believe one of the tablets was sent to the BCA, and that tested negative for fentanyl. So, but Dr. McGee's testimony was he died of hypoxia. Hypoxia started. That was the mechanism. Lowering blood oxygen levels. As your blood oxygen levels go down, your blood vessels become permeable. That resulted in pulmonary edema, and that resulted in cerebral edema. And when asked point blank, Dr. McGee, and this is on 312 to 313, there was no sign of any injury or disease that would account for the cerebral edema. Overall, Dr. McGee concluded there was no physical malady that would account for the victim's death, and that was on 325. So the cause of death is his brain swelled and it herniated down through his brainstem. That's what killed him.
And what caused that?
That's what Dr. McGee said. There's a variety of explanations for it. There could be disease, there could be illness, there could be physical trauma. He saw none of those there. The other thing that he pointed to was a drug overdose, specifically an opioid. Both heroin and fentanyl are opioids.
Which is what identified Mr. Miller.
No, the Jim Baggy that tested positive with the BCA, that tested positive for heroin and fentanyl.
You just argued a little bit ago that it was the tie, one, and to Judge Connolly's question, it was a tie between the heroin and the fentanyl and not the tie between the Xanax and the fentanyl. And you agreed. I mean, that's what distinguished between the Xanax fentanyl given by the friend at noon and the heroin fentanyl that you just said that Dr. McGee testified was the cause that he pointed to.
Yes, and the testing of that gem baggie that tested positive for heroin and fentanyl, that was testing was done by the BCA, unchallenged here today. Had that been reversed?
But the problem, I mean, okay, so the gym bag, there was heroin in it. But what gets the conviction was, and it was the heroin fentanyl that killed him. So that kind of tie, I mean, isn't that the nail in the coffin? I mean, you know, because maybe he didn't take the heroin from the bag. Maybe he took, you know, I don't know, whatever else you take. But the toxicology report is what sort of tied it all together. And that's why I don't understand how this is, you know, anything but reversible error, speaking for myself.
As I started to say earlier, this is a unique case. This has a unique set of facts. We have evidence showing that
You got the text messages, you know, that's
defendant
all.
Admitted that he dropped the bag off that evening and then left. I think that was 7:15, 7:30, sometime in that time frame.
Let me ask you this. Do you think you could have convicted him without the toxicology report?
Absolutely.
Even though you had to prove cause of death?
Right. Well, we did prove, they did prove cause of death.
And what was the cause of death? Fentanyl and heroin?
Nobody could say. What the cause of death in the death report is mixed drugs toxicity. But
isn't that what part of when you say this case is unique and we look at the fifth factor, whether the other evidence of guilt was overwhelming for harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? I mean, isn't that the issue that we have a case here where Mr. Miller was not the only person that the evidence showed had shared drugs with the victim? The victim died after ingesting drugs given to him by one person, and what the evidence showed, even without the toxicology report, was given by Mr. Miller. Now, it seems to me like your argument that the other evidence being overwhelming would be a lot stronger, and you would be able to answer even more strongly to Judge Connolly if you were able to say, Mr. Miller is the only person who gave him drugs that day, but that's not the case here. And so that's why it seems hard for us to say harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Why is that wrong?
Swiatek testified to the rapid onset of opioids and how it can cause the mechanism of death. She talked about the pharmaceutical side of it. Dr. McGee talked about the biological side of it, how the rapid onset leads to what happened here. It's that rapid onset, the only drugs that the state put into evidence that he would have ingested in that time frame that would cause him to die were the drugs that were provided by the defendant. The drugs he ingested earlier in the day with Mr. Hammond, yes, he tested positive for fentanyl, but obviously not a lethal dose of fentanyl because he was around all day and then went to the hospital later. So if he consumed the same drugs, this is just a call for the jury to make. Where did he get those drugs? The drugs that killed him had to have come from that bag and that those lines that are in the photograph. Those are the drugs that killed him. Those are the drugs that were provided by the appellant. Yes, there's other arguments, but the fact that there's other people that the defense counsel was able to point the finger at, that shows how this had no bearing on the ultimate issue. What drugs did he consume, and which ones are the ones that killed him?
And it wasn't the fentanyl, is what you're saying.
Based on my reading of it, Swiatek says that heroin metabolizes incredibly fast.
What did the prosecutor argue to the jury in terms of what killed him?
Just that there was mixed drugs toxicity, that the drugs he took from the bag that was supplied to him by Mr. Miller, those are the drugs that killed him.
So did not argue fentanyl killed him?
To that, I don't remember, but okay.
But if
yes.
The prosecutor did argue to the jury, well, the fentanyl contributed to his death, doesn't that make, you know, the toxicology report saying this was fentanyl relevant to the guilty verdict?
No, because the fentanyl shows up in the baggie, and that baggie was provided by, the jury could reasonably conclude that's the baggie that came from the defendant. It had both heroin and fentanyl. Which one killed him is irrelevant. Third degree is a Schedule 1 or 2 offense. Heroin is a Schedule 1 drug. Fentanyl is a Schedule 2 drug. McGee and Swiatek don't make that differentiation. They label them both opioids. The difference between a Schedule 1 and a Schedule 2 is whether the Schedule 1 has no therapeutic value. So heroin is a Schedule 1. Fentanyl is a Schedule 2 because it has limited therapeutic value, but they're both opioids.
I just have a final question for you. What's your position on precedential or non-precedential? Do you agree with your counterpart that this should be precedential?
My time is up. May I answer that? I'm representing the state in State versus Aaron Shea. That case was decided in September, I believe, and that specifically addressed it. And the Supreme Court has granted review on that. So that one will be coming down the pipeline, and that will address it straight on. Obviously, that'll be a precedential decision when that's...
Shea was non-precedential, right?
The decision below was non-precedential, but yes, that one will be deciding this case. But I've conceded that there was a violation because this case is material than how the evidence came in Shea.
Thank you, Mr. Maxson.
I would note, Judge Ead, that the Shea case, as you may recall, involved resolving the case on the fourth prong of the plain error test, and this court in that case went on to make determinations that the substitute witness in that case actually was involved in the testing in some way, and that is remarkably different than this case. This was objected to and well litigated,
right.
And it was objected to under Caulfield Weaver. Yes. I disagree with counsel for the state that the state could have proved beyond a reasonable doubt cause of death and relatedly proximate cause of death without the toxicology. The rapid onset of death testimony, which was squarely toxicology-based testimony, squarely resolved the case. I agree with Your Honor that it put the nail in the coffin on the case. That's exactly what it did, and it is what the prosecutor told the jury that it did. To Judge Larkin's question about what did the prosecutor argue, their primary argument and their final argument in rebuttal was really that the scientific evidence resolved that there was a sudden death. And so, jury, all you need to know is that the drugs that were taken last in time that day caused the death. And there was no dispute that of the various drugs that the victim was supplied that day, that Mr. Miller's were last in time. The prosecution, and I agree, that defense counsel argued that maybe other drugs killed the victim, but I just want to put a fine point on the fact that without the toxicology, that argument actually becomes strong. With the toxicology coming into evidence, that argument is weak, if not meritless. Again, it puts the nail in the coffin on whether the drugs taken earlier in the day, hours earlier, could have indicated and put into motion a sudden death, because there's nothing sudden about hours transpiring.
So when you say it would have been stronger without the toxicology, mm-hmm. the defense argument, was there any suggestion in the evidence that the victim could have taken any other drugs during the time frame? I mean, how would that have been argued, I guess, that led to the sudden death? Other than what was supplied, as Mr. Magnus pointed out, the kind of very tragic play-by-play that played out over the text messages.
Without the toxicology evidence, the state put on a stand a witness who said, I did illicit drugs with the victim earlier on the day he died. We took street Xanax. I believe that was laced with fentanyl because I went and tested and I was positive for fentanyl. That was essentially the defense's argument, that the victim had taken various drugs, and it is a reasonably open question as to which drugs were the fatal ones. The toxicology makes that argument meritless for all the reasons I've described today and for all the reasons that the medical examiner and the surrogate witness said. We have a sudden death. That becomes impossible. The defense's theory becomes impossible with the toxicology evidence of a sudden death. I hope I'm making this clearer rather than muddier. And the only point I was trying to make there is really a simple that one. With the toxicology, it was conclusive proof as to which drugs killed the victim. It went directly to the essential element of probable cause of death. It was the most important evidence to the state in this case. And with that, the state can't meet its burden to prove that the constitutional confrontation error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we would ask that a new trial be granted. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll issue an opinion in the statutory time frame. That concludes our oral argument calendar today. We are in recess.
All rise.